Hello and welcome to the Science Podcast for November 7th, 2008. I'm Robert Frederick. This week, it's not just genes influencing social behavior, but social behavior influencing genes. Mental disorders with genetic ties to chromosome 17 and switching memories on and off. All this and more, plus our usual roundup of stories from our free online daily news site, Science Now.
Support for the Science Podcast is provided by AAAS, the Science Society, publishers of Science Magazine, advancing science, engineering, and innovation throughout the world for the benefit of all people. The American Association for the Advancement of Science at www.aaas.org.
Scientists have long studied how genes influence social behavior. For example, a particular genetic variation in Drosophila affects the timing of the insect's courtship song, which in turn influences its reproductive behavior. But genes don't just influence social behavior. There's also a growing body of research on how social behavior influences genes, and particularly gene expression. As a part of a special section on neurogenetics in this week's Science, Gene Robinson and colleagues discussed the dynamics of that two-way relationship between genes and social behavior. I spoke with Robinson from his office at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign.
So the typical relationship between genes and behavior is that you have the causal arrow going from genes to behavior. And while that is true, and while that certainly applies to social behavior, we wanted to highlight the reverse arrow. The dynamic nature of the genome, the fact that social information, social influences can affect brain function and affect then subsequent behavior, and it exerts some of its effects on the genome in the brain cells that are involved in coordinating behavior.
So just so that I'm clear, there are genes then that specify some behaviors directly, instincts, things like that?
Well, one has to consider the proposition very carefully. So you need to interpret results of experiments in two different ways. So there are experiments where you can insert a gene or even a small piece of a gene into one organism and get it to change its behavior. So that leads one to think, oh my God, you know, a little piece of a little gene or a little even a part of a gene can actually determine or specify a behavior. And that's what it sounds like. But what's lurking beneath the surface that's not easy to discern is that that gene must be acting in the context of a series of very complex and at this point only dimly understood networks. And by networks, I mean it in many different ways. Neural networks, that is neural circuits, networks of genes producing proteins that then interact. So molecular pathways is what I mean by that. And so this gene that you've inserted must, in order to have its effects, must be interacting with many, many other components, both molecular components and neural components. So can you insert a gene into an organism and get a change in behavior? Or can you change the expression of a particular gene in an organism and get a change in behavior? Can it be a striking change in behavior? Yes. Does that gene do the job alone? No.
I suppose these interpretations must be even harder to tease out when looking at social behaviors.
Indeed, because social behavior is something that's most removed, furthest away from the DNA. Not only is it the production of a particular act, but social behavior by definition means that there are influences of other individuals, conspecifics, that act to shape whether another individual is going to perform a behavior, how often it's going to perform it, how intensely it's going to perform it. So there's a lot more subtlety to social behavior.
Now, what about social behavior affecting genes? How does that play out? What's an example of that?
Mm-hmm. Well, the first example of that was something that came from the world of the songbirds. So songbirds, and we focused on zebra finch as one of the main experimental models, songbirds engage in rich social interactions that are mediated by song. They communicate a lot via song. So work from David Clayton's laboratory.
One of your co-authors.
Yes, that's right. Showed that when a male hears the song of another male, that experience of hearing the song triggers the expression of a particular gene, turns that gene on in a particular region of the brain that's devoted to hearing. And then subsequent experiments have shown that that is a socially mediated phenomenon, because it's not that the bird shows this molecular response in response to any kind of sound, but it has to be the species-specific song. We know from other studies, ethological studies, that hearing a male song will lead this bird to engage in a variety of possible responses. If it's an unfamiliar song, the male might get alert and say, "Oh, I don't recognize that. There must be some intruder in the territory," and respond then accordingly. If it's a familiar sound, then the male can respond by saying to himself, we infer based on behavioral experiments, "Ah, yeah, that's Joe. I know Joe. He lives, in my territory, and it's so there's nothing strange going on here," and then can respond behaviorally in accordance with that assessment.
Are these genes that are affected by social behavior conserved across, well, not just species, but other organisms?
Yes, that's exactly right. A good example of that comes from the work on the honeybee that was performed in my laboratory. So we looked at a gene that was discovered in fruit flies in the laboratory of Marla Sokolowski, the foraging gene. In the fruit fly, that genetic variability results in the flies showing different kinds of foraging behavior. So flies that inherit one form of the gene forage very actively. They're called rovers. And flies that inherit another form of this gene forage more in a more limited way, and they're called sitters. So rovers show higher activity of this gene, and sitters show lower activity of this gene. These are inherited fixed differences between these two. In the case of the honeybee, we have striking changes in behavior, not so much between individuals on a fixed basis, but changes in behavior that occur as the bees grow up. They have an age-related division of labor. When they're young, they work in the hive. And then when they're about 2.5 to 3 weeks, they sort of graduate and become foragers. So we hypothesize that there is an increase in the expression of this gene in the brain of the honeybee as it gets older, and that if we were able to manipulate the expression of this gene, we could get a young bee becoming a forager prematurely. And that's exactly what we found. So this then gave us this insight that genes can be very conserved. They can have sort of similar functions across a great span of evolutionary time. Flies and bees diverged about 300 million years ago, and yet we're able to take a gene from the fly and use what it does in the fly as a hint for what it might be doing in the bee. And of course, the fly, it's foraging in this solitary way. In the bee, the age at onset of foraging is socially regulated. If you remove all the foragers in a hive, some of the young bees will grow up and become foragers prematurely. And knowing they're sensitive to the social environment, that prompted us to take a genomic approach and look at the activity of thousands of genes in the bee brain as a function of social context. And just as the songbird story would have predicted, bees that are showing, that are exposed to different social environments, that is, presence of older bees or absence of older bees, they show changes in thousands of genes in the brain in response to that change in social condition.
What about in people? What are the prospects for this research in these model social species translating to understanding social behavior in us?
Well, there are a couple of points of contact to be made. First of all, using model social species will allow us to really develop a nice understanding of gene functions and how these gene functions are contributing to a social system. So that's certainly one major point of contact. Secondly, the evolutionary perspective, which genes have been very conserved, which genes are less conserved, and those then suggest different roles in our understanding then of human social behavior.
Gene Robinson, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Gene Robinson is lead author of a review article on genes and social behavior. Read the article in this week's Science. In In his last day as director of the National Institutes of Health, Elias Zerhouni put in place a formal policy intended as a kind of affirmative action for early career researchers. Here with more about it is Science Deputy Editor Barbara Jasny.
Last Friday, Elias Zerhouni announced that NIH intends to support new investigators at success rates comparable to those for established investigators submitting new applications. It sounds minor, but it represents a big change. Established researchers tend to fare better in peer review than first-time applicants because they have a track record and stacks of data to back up their proposals. That gap widened in the past couple of years as peer reviewers seemed to be punishing the young investigators with bad scores, as Zerhouni told Science. Next year, the new policy will result in at least 1,650 R01 grants going to new investigators. That's an additional 300 of the NIH's main type of research grants, up from a low of 1,350 grants in 2006. One thing that prompted this decision is that the average age at which researchers receive their first NIH research grant has been creeping up for decades and is now 42. By 2020, researchers over 68 years old with NIH grants could outnumber those under 38. These trends were a major concern to Zerhouni in the 6 years he ran NIH. He persuaded the heads of NIH's member institutes to award more grants to young researchers and established new grants for first-time applicants. For the past 2 years, he made sure that the number of grants awarded to new investigators could not fall below a certain minimum. Zerhouni's announcement last Friday put in place a formal NIH policy intended as a kind of affirmative action for early career researchers. Zerhouni sees the move as vital. In his last interview with Science as NIH director, he said, "Anybody who thinks this is not the number one issue in American science probably doesn't understand the long-term issues."
That was Deputy Editor Barbara Jasny with a policy update from Science and the AAAS Center for Science, Technology, and Congress. Next week, we'll have more on science and technology policy following the 2008 presidential election. Until then, you can read more about President-elect Barack Obama's stance on science policy issues at election2008.aaas.org. Everything about how your body is made is contained in the 46 chromosomes you carry around, which in turn contain an estimated 25,000 genes. Sometimes the tiniest genetic variation is quite apparent, say giving you green eyes instead of brown. But many other genetic variations remain hidden from view or show up during development, such as with mental retardation. In this week's Science, Elizabeth Panisi reports on research surrounding genetic variations in a particular region of chromosome 17, which is associated with mental retardation, Alzheimer's, and even cancer.
This is a story that looks at a piece of chromosome. Normally, when I write about genomics, I either think about it in terms of this specific gene and what's happening to this specific gene, or I sort of have the bird's eye view where I look at the whole genome and what's happening across the whole genome. But this little piece of chromosome seem particularly interesting. It's associated with several different diseases. It's had an interesting evolutionary history, and a lot of scientists are just curious about it.
What are some of the diseases that are associated with this particular part of the chromosome?
Well, one of the earliest associations came relative to Alzheimer's disease. So early on, about 1990s, there was the thinking that these tangles that form in the brain of Alzheimer's disease patients might be causative. And they track down the protein, the gene for the protein that's in these tangles, to a gene that's on chromosome 17 at this particular location. It's abbreviated as MAPT, MAPT, for T for tau. It's called the tau protein. That's how it's often referred to as. And then, since it was associated with the Alzheimer's disease, other researchers started looking at other types of dementias that had tangles. And one is called Pick's disease, and they actually track down a mutation that causes the disease. Another disease that's associated with this region is progressive supranuclear palsy. And then most recently, in the last 2 years, several groups of researchers have linked this section of chromosome to mental retardation.
What's unusual about this region?
Well, what's interesting about this region and something they discovered when they were looking at its relationship to some of these dementias is to study the dementias, the gene's relationship to the dementias, what they would do would sequence the gene in a lot of people. And what they noticed is that in some people, in particular some Europeans, part of the region was flipped over or inverted relative to the rest of the region. So basically the region comes in two forms. It has a what they call a direct form and an inverted form. And in the inverted form, some of the genes are facing backwards relative to the direct form.
Well, is that what causes these various diseases to occur or?
Well, in particular, what happens is when it flips over, it sets up certain stretches of DNA in such a way that when the DNA is being copied and rearranged, pieces of DNA can get dropped out. And what was discovered by three different groups is these pieces of DNA that get dropped out are associated with mental retardation. So what they discovered is that there's a microdeletion syndrome that's associated with mental retardation.
Now, you said this just occurred in Europeans.
Well, this is the curious thing about this piece of chromosome and this inverted regions. Once they discovered there were these two forms of this region of chromosome 17, researchers looked in all different populations across the world, and they found that it can be in 20% of Europeans, but it's almost non-existent in Asians and almost non-existent in Africans. So that led people to begin to try and think about, well, how did this arise? How did this inversion arise and which came first? And it's actually been quite surprising because as they've studied the evolution of this, it's turned out that they sort of had the scenario backwards. So, for example, you would think that the direct version, which is found all over the world in African, Asian, European, whatever, would be the ancestral version, and that sometime in human history, that piece of chromosome got flipped over, and you'd have a group of people that would have this genetic variation, and that group of people turns out to be the Europeans. However, when researchers looked deeper into the primate history and looked at this region in macaques and chimpanzees and orangutans, they found out that in reality, the inverted form is what's in macaques and in most orangutans and in some chimpanzees. So their conclusion is that what we call the inverted form is really the more ancestral form of this chromosome. And then at some point in time, about 2 million years ago, this flip occurred to cause what is now the most common form of this chromosome in people now.
What does that say about this 20% of European population?
Who knows? There are several ideas. One is that this inverted form somehow was disadvantageous, and so people who carried the inverted form basically died out, except for a very few people. And those happened to be among the people who migrated from Africa into Europe. And then somehow in Europe, that inverted form proved advantageous, and so it spread. And so that's why you have it in the Europeans. Whereas in everywhere else, that inverted form disappeared.
So what's the next step then? Is it to scan parents to see if they have this inversion and perhaps counsel them against having children because they're at much higher risk perhaps for dementia or mental retardation?
I don't think that that's the next step. I think the next step for the people interested in this region of the chromosome is to identify more kids with mental retardation who have the microdeletion syndrome. I think in many children with mental retardation, there's no explanation for what happened and why. And parents really want to understand what happened and why. And knowing that this microdeletion syndrome exists gives clinical geneticists something to test for. And I think that's what's happening now. They're testing kids who have no explanation for why they have their disorder and telling parents what's really going on, if that's what's really going on. But so far, this has only explained a small proportion of the unexplained mental retardation. However, the fact that these microdeletion syndromes exist give researchers ideas about other places in the genome they might look to see if there are other microdeletion syndromes that are waiting to be discovered.
Liz Panisi, thank you very much.
Well, thank you. It's been nice talking to you.
Science's Elizabeth Panisi reports on a region of chromosome 17 and its import to human evolution and disease. Read her article in this week's Science. For most of us, it takes many attempts to learn something new. In the brain, learning or committing something to long-term memory, say, the words of a poem, is quite different than the short-term memory needed to remember, say, where you're supposed to meet your friend for dinner. Finding the switch to turn short-term memories into long-term ones is the work of Mauro Costamattioli, this year's winner of the Eppendorf and Science Prize for Neurobiology. In an essay in this week's Science, Costamattioli writes about his research over the past few years on turning memories on and off. I spoke with him from his office at Baylor College of Medicine in Houston, Texas.
We know from the past that the formation of long-term memories required the synthesis of new proteins. But we didn't know which were those proteins, and we didn't know how this process was regulated. So I decided to work in a factor which regulates two fundamental processes for the formation of long-lasting memories. One is the formation of new proteins. As I just told you, it's important for the formation of long-lasting memories. And this factor also regulates a memory repressor gene. So I decided to alter the activity of this factor and see whether memory will be modified. And we were happily surprised that indeed, by either increasing or decreasing the activity, we were able to enhance or impair memories.
So you and your collaborators have been investigating what happens in the brain that makes what might normally be a short-term memory into a long-term one. Is that right?
Right. So usually, as we predicted, that by decreasing the activity of this factor, which is called EIF2-alpha, an experience that usually induces a short-lasting change will induce a long-lasting one. We decided this was at the goal of our study, and indeed this is what happened, because when we decrease the activity of this factor, we'll increase a bit protein synthesis, and we also decrease this memory repressor, and as a consequence, a weak protocol or a short experience induce a long-lasting memory in mice with decreased activity of EIF2-alpha.
What kind of memories are these for mice, these short-term memories?
Right, for mice and humans, we have two, well, we can empirically define two kind of memories, short-term memory, which lasts minutes or even hours, and we have long-lasting memories, which they can last for days, months, and even a lifetime. So the conversion from short-term memory to long-term memory, this process required a new gene expression and required the expression of new proteins. So we identify now this factor, which is called EIF2-alpha, that we claim that control this gene expression and is the one that control the switch from short-term memory to long-term memory.
Is this the same mechanism for changing short-term memory to long-term memory for other species?
Yeah, so this is a quite conserved process. So the conversion from short-term memory to long-term memory and the need for new protein synthesis was shown in different phyla. It was shown in mice. It was shown in rats. It was shown in invertebrates. So this is quite conserved. And indeed, I may argue that the first clues or molecular clues of the conversion from short-term memory to long-term memory emerged back in the 60s, where protein synthesis inhibitors were injected in the brain, and as a consequence, long-term memory was blocked, but short-term memory was just normal. So this is a clear molecular distinction from short-term memory and long-term memory. Again, long-term memory requires new protein synthesis, but short-term memory, it does not.
And is that what your team did too, inject?
So we predicted that if this factor were to control the new protein synthesis, what about if we regulate the activity of this factor? So we generate those animals, and we gave to those animals protocols that were very weak. It was very difficult for a wild-type animal to generate a long-lasting memory. But those mutant animals, they generate a long-lasting memory.
So genetically down-regulating this.
Right. So what we have done is we just decrease the activity of this factor, and as a consequence, the expression of genes which is needed for memory formation was enhanced. And that's the reason why a short-lasting protocol induces a long-lasting memory. It is important also to mention that we not only decreased the activity of EIF2-alpha and found the memory was enhanced, but also we have done the opposite. We increased the activity and we found that we are also able to impair memory. So this is like kind of a switch that whenever the activity of this factor is down, memories are enhanced, but whenever the activity of this factor is high, memories are impaired.
Now, you said this was also the same mechanism as in other species. What about in people? Is this what's behind how some people seem to have amazing long-term memory capacity?
Well, this could be certainly a possibility. We know about autistic savant people that they just learn things without repetition. So in our case, or for normal people, we need repetition. Practice makes perfect.
So these are further experiments than perhaps to look at people.
Well, certainly. So the next step will be we can look at two things. We can look and see whether in those patients, when those people that they have a great memory, there's kind of a mutation in this protein that will decrease the activity, and that's the reason why enhanced memory. But I think the more interesting question to see is whether in patients which, for instance, they're suffering from Alzheimer's disease or other cognitive disorders, to see whether that switch is off, that could explain the reason by which memory is being impaired in those patients.
Mauro Costamatioli, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mauro Costamatioli is the winner of this year's Eppendorf and Science Prize for Neurobiology for his work on switching memories on and off. You can read his essay in this week's Science. Finally today, David Grimm, editor of Science's free online daily news site, Science Now, joins us to talk about the latest science news. Hi, David.
Hey, Rob.
So what stories do you have for us today?
Well, Rob, we're going to be talking about force fields coming a little closer to reality, about dolphin love fetishes, and finally, how to get diesel fuel from a tree fungus.
Wow. Well, let's start with force fields. I thought this was something out of science fiction.
Right. And especially if you think of something like Star Trek and the enemy ship attacks and the red alert blares and the captain says, shields up. This has always been in the realm of science fiction, but a group of physicists have brought this a little closer to reality. And what they've done is they've taken a cue from nuclear fusion research. And what happens in nuclear fusion reactors is that these reactors have to generate powerful magnetic fields that confine particles so that they don't escape. And what the researchers wondered is there a way to sort of reverse this process? So instead of keeping these particles in, you'd want to keep them out.
Well, other than fusion in confining these high-energy particles, how would repelling them be important?
Well, Rob, when astronauts go out into outer space, they're no longer protected by Earth's magnetic field, which shields us from these particles. And these particles are actually really dangerous because they can damage DNA, which, as you know, is not a good thing. And especially if we're talking about astronauts going on long trips where they're going to be in open space for a long period of time, they're going to need as much shielding from these particles as possible. But up until now, it's been unclear about how engineers would solve this problem.
So they can really take this nuclear fusion research and apply it in some sort of small transportable device?
Well, that's the idea. And when this team ran simulations of what they envisioned such a force field would look like, they found that their force field did protect against a lot of these high-energy particles. And they also found in the simulation that this force field could be generated to be about a few hundred meters wide, which would protect a craft in space. But they also found that such a device wouldn't need nearly as much energy as a nuclear fusion reactor. So it's conceivable something could be made a lot more portable than the fusion reactors we have now.
Well, I imagine this is still quite a long way off.
Exactly. This is still in a very early phase. We're just talking about simulations right now. We're not even talking about prototype devices or anything like that. And experts say that although the idea is intriguing, there's no evidence to suggest that such a device would protect against all of the harmful rays in outer space, or even exactly how it would work in the first place. So we're just at a very early step, but it's a step nonetheless, getting us a little closer to what we see in science fiction.
Well, from fiction to fetish, dolphin love fetishes. What are dolphin love fetishes? That sounds like fiction itself.
Well, dolphin love fetishes are objects, in this case, objects that belonging to dolphins, that people ascribe special powers and properties to. And in this case, we're talking about the Amazonian river dolphin, or it's known locally as the Boto. And the Boto has some interesting legends around it. Locals say that at night, the Boto transforms itself into a Caucasian man that seduces young women women. And they've actually used this legend to explain why there's a lot of unexplained teenage pregnancies in the region. And they also have this idea that if you possess certain parts of the Boto, say a dried eye or ground up genitalia, that this will make you more attractive to the opposite sex.
I imagine that's not very good for the Boto.
Exactly. And a team of researchers wanted to see if the Boto was actually being impacted by this trade in dolphin fetishes. In other words, was it actually pieces of the Boto that were being bought and sold in the first place?
Or were there other animals that were being used as substitutes?
Exactly. And so what they did was they procured 43 salted eyeballs from various cities along the Amazon, and they ran DNA tests on them, and they compared this DNA with a lot of different animals. And what they found is none of those eyeballs actually belonged to the Boto. A lot of them belonged to another type of dolphin, and actually a few of them belonged to pigs and sheep.
So it doesn't sound as if the Boto is actually being impacted at all.
Right. According to this study, the Boto is not suffering from this trade because its parts aren't being taken. But its status as a species is unclear. And if you look at places like China, where there was a dolphin there called the Baji, that dolphin, another landlocked dolphin like the Boto, actually went extinct because of human hunting. So there is a lesson in there for the Amazon.
Well, from hunting dolphin love fetishes to hunting renewable sources of energy, how do you get diesel fuel from a tree fungus?
Well, it's a good question, Rob. And this story has to do with a novel fungus that was found in an ulmo tree in Patagonia. And the search for fuel-producing microbes is a really hot topic in synthetic biology because scientists are trying to find a way to wean us off of fossil fuels. So they want to see if there's any microbes out there that will do the job better than all the drilling and the other stuff that we're doing. And lo and behold, this fungus that this group found in this tree produces a staggering amount of volatile hydrocarbons.
Now, by amount, you mean different varieties or pure volume?
Different varieties, and researchers have found microorganisms from time to time that produce a handful of these compounds, but never so many compounds in just one organism.
Have researchers figured out what this does for the fungus producing all these hydrocarbons?
Well, they speculate that these compounds help the fungus inhibit the growth of other organisms nearby. So it's sort of an offensive maneuver so this fungus can control whatever environment that it lives in. But the really interesting thing about all these hydrocarbons is that they're the same type of chemicals that are found in gasoline and diesel fuel and even in jet fuel. So there is the raw ingredients there for an organism that produces something that could be very valuable to humans.
Well, how efficient is this fungus? You said there was a lot of variety, but not a lot of volume.
Right. As is, the fungus is not terribly useful because it's not producing these compounds in high enough amounts to be useful. But the idea is that synthetic biologists might be able to manipulate the fungus or take some of the fungus's genes and put it in another organism and eventually come up with an organism that produces these compounds at very high levels and with very high efficiency.
So the next step then is to sequence this fungus and figure out what its genetic code is.
You bet.
Okay. Well, thanks, Dave.
Thanks, Rob.
So what other stories are you looking into for science? Now.
Well, Rob, we're looking into stories about the first gene that's been tied to speech disorders, about how memories get moved around in the brain, and finally, new insights into how thalidomide caused birth defects in babies in the last century. So be sure to check out the site.
David Grimm is the editor of Science Now, the free online daily news site of science. You can catch up on the latest science news at sciencenow.sciencemag.org. And that wraps up the November 7th, 2008 Science Podcast. If you have any comments or suggestions for the show, please write us at sciencepodcast@aaas.org. The show is a production of Science Magazine and of AAAS, the Science Society. The content is provided by the news and editorial staff of Science, and Jeffrey Cook composed the music. I'm Robert Frederick. On behalf of Science Magazine and its publisher, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, thanks for joining us.